having on mathematics is that for the first time, and again, this meeting is important for this, for the first time, mathematical technology becomes a consciously recognized discipline, a component of science and of technology, of the whole science-technology complex. Instead of being just a matter of practitioners who didn't seem to be in the mainstream, computing now becomes the queen of technology. This, I'm willing to grant it that that title, and I don't suppose I'll have too much argument. Some of you perhaps think it ought to be the king, but at this period, I think in our history, we should use all the queen terminology and notation possible in order to comply. This is really something new. Undoubtedly, you don't know this particular book that I'm going to mention, but there are several books which study the mathematical practitioners of the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. Difficult to study because, again, they aren't represented in the sort of official literature, you see. But there was there has always been, and there was in particular during that time, a large group of people who were sort of experts in calculation. And this was true in Greek times, too. You may have heard it said, for instance, that the Romans couldn't calculate because, you know, that Roman number system was so awkward. Or that the Greeks couldn't calculate because they used the alphabet to name the first few numbers. This is absolutely historically wrong. We do have plenty of evidence that those people were very skilled in calculation. It's not even true that system for representing numbers by alphabetical letters is so bad. After all you need is a multiplication table, and you can do a lot of things with a lot of different systems. And there's plenty of evidence to show that it was not uncommon at all in 2,000 or 3,000 years ago for people to be able to do things like calculate square roots to 15 or what would be equivalent to 15 or 20 decimal places, to several sexagesimal places. They were able to do a very great deal in calculation. Again, it's not recorded, but we know it must have been there. But now we have a new stage, I think, in the development, and that is where computing comes to be not something sort of done quietly by so-called just technicians or practitioners, but it becomes an important discipline in its own right. And of course, we can see why. From what it used to be, calculation was kind of a chore which had a rather narrow scope. That is, it was just a matter of calculating numerical answers, and it didn't seem very interesting. But now, the electronic computer has enlarged the whole, it's not only enlarged the capacity and the speed for calculation, but it's also enlarged the whole concept of what computing is, so that it becomes synonymous with organized information handling, with algorithmic treatment of things. And this I think is a one way of looking, and perhaps an illuminating way of looking at the meaning of what is going on now, that we have developing the most general and most abstract and most effective methods of handling information. And this is a almost complete analog in that area of the role of mathematics as the most general and abstract and widely applicable theoretical structures, collection of theoretical structures which have the characteristic of being more abstract, more widely applicable, not less practical, more practical, than any others, just because of this abstractness. So that if this way of thinking about the matter is helpful, and it could be a rather useful way of looking at the history of computing, and it perhaps could also be a useful way of looking at policy questions. It certainly fits with the tendency, clear tendency, for computer science to become an independent discipline, but a discipline linked with mathematics very closely, and linked with electronic and other technology very closely. Of course, whether or not it's this way of thinking about things is useful can only be told by experience, and I won't be too disappointed if it turns out not to be useful. I just hope that it's this idea may be stimulating to people interested in the field, and in particular that it's been stimulating to you. I was told that questions were always in order, and I'm not behind time, so I'd be glad to answer any questions. Now, I'd also appreciate understanding if people took advantage of a slightly longer break, because great as the program is for this conference, it doesn't allow too much free time. Thank you very much.
Other questions for Professor May?
May I set down a couple of ground rules, please? Jack has let me pretend that I'm not a professor these days, put on my crusty old colonel's attitude. In order to get these things down, we ask you to follow very rigidly a couple of basic rules. These microphones have an antenna. They should be held about somewhere 4 to 8 inches from your mouth. When you start to speak, push the button and hold it down. Push the button about half a second before you start to speak. And be sure to state clearly your name and identification before you start. If you start talking and don't identify yourself, either I or Chris or one of the other people is going to say, whoa, stop, and we're going to ask you to start over from scratch. If you follow that rule, we'll get a good record, and this is important to us.
There's a gentleman right behind you there.
Ulam, University of Colorado. You talked about Gauss being such a marvelous calculator, which apparently is so. But weren't there modern calculators in the 19th century, and even now? I think one mathematician in Scotland, Aiken, was trying to explain how he did it. I don't think fully explained it. Is there any recent psychological or otherwise scientific study of how the calculators do it? I think some are superior.
You're talking about calculating prodigies.
Right.
There were many in the 19th century.
Now, yes.
One little footnote on this: Gauss was offered the use of such prodigies to help him with many of his calculations, and he never accepted this because he said that it was more trouble to explain to them what he was doing than to do it himself.
Well,
I think
but
he was faster. But to directly answer your question, there have been some studies, not very many. It's one of the difficulties is that there are very few such people now. It seems to have been a phenomenon that came and went. But there is, I think the best comment I've seen, the best insight I've seen on this is that it seems to depend on a remarkable visual memory in most cases. But this certainly isn't true in every case. And it's there are such anomalies as there are people who can do these calculations and can do nothing else. You know, sometimes they call in French, call them idiot savant because of this. So the answer is no, we know very little about this.
Next question here.
Nat Rochester from IBM. You recommend that we save all sorts of documents of historical significance and so forth. Where should they be put? Because the tremendous scarcity of documents that should have been saved that I've encountered from time to time, and there's a real problem.
Well, that's a good question. There is one of the things that I put some reprints out of is an appeal for preservation of historical documents, which was made some years ago, and it talks about this problem. But what I'll say is this. The answer, in a general way, is quite clear. There are many depositories who will take these documents. Most universities have an archive. They want material. There are some universities and libraries that specialize in this. For instance, I believe that the University of Wyoming at the present time is very anxious to build up an archive of mathematical, and that would be include computer science, documentation. There are museums, there are private libraries, there's places like Library of Congress and the Smithsonian, many, many places. And I think the most practical thing is this. Save your own material. And of course, don't save everything, you know. I throw away about 9 out of 10 of the things that come through my hands, but you can tell when something has some interest, some possible interest. So save your own material, and then before you die, give material or put in your will the giving of the material to a depository, that is a library, or some such place, or an archive. And this is very simple, but it's good to go and know that they will accept it. And you'll find it very reassuring that these places have archivists, and they will take your material, they will sort it, they will file it, they'll catalog it, they'll put it, they'll handle it properly. Don't let this be up to your heirs. That's the trouble. Don't have a grand spree burning up stuff. That's number one, which many people have done. And don't leave it to your heirs, because heirs do surprising things. One sort of thing that often happens is that heirs decide that the stuff must be worth money, so they start sitting on it. And in the course of their sitting on it, gets lost. That very, very frequently happens. And you simply cannot depend on the future generations to do your bidding. You better do it yourself if you want the stuff deposited. Of course, if you know someone whose material is somewhere, who's already dead, say, and whose material is somewhere, for heaven's sake, take the initiative to try to get it in an archive someplace.
Betty Holberton, National Bureau of Standards. I wanted to ask a question on how to deal with the change in terminology that has come across this industry. 30 years of work has been tremendous, and groups working independently have developed their own terminology, so that when you start to write about something, it will be totally uncomprehensible to the modern day. Should you translate that to the terms that are now being used and make footnotes back to your work so that the historian who wants to go back and take it up can do that? I found this is one of the problems, is terminology.
Oh, well, it's a tremendous problem, and it's discussed. You know, it's never going to be completely solved. It's really difficult for the historian of mathematics to avoid looking back at something and seeing in it something in his own terms. And the danger is, of course, it's desirable to translate into modern terminology so that the modern non-expert can understand what's going on. But if you're to avoid misunderstanding or misinterpretation, I think you have to accompany that by explanation always, and if possible, by the original terminology. See, if you, a typical example is, this is a classic example. You undoubtedly heard the statement that the Greeks had the real numbers, because the Eudoxian definition of proportion gives a criteria for the equality, inequality of real numbers. It's just the same as Dedekind's. But, you know, if you say that they have something which is logically equivalent to the real numbers, by our standards, that's okay. But the catch with that usual statement is that the Greeks would have been shocked to death at any such suggestion, because they knew that the only numbers were the integers. And these things that Eudoxus was working with were proportions between integers. There wasn't any business, any possibility there being such a thing as a real number. So I think the only answer is you should give the original terminology, give the what modern equivalent. If you're going to be really careful, if it's not just a popularization, you really have to do that. And of course, now I'll make a plea for some scholars to develop dictionaries. You can't do scholarly work, you can't really work systematically in any field without dictionaries in that field. We take that for granted in our ordinary English language. Every one of us owns a dictionary, and we are able to go and find out the nuances of words we use. We don't have that in mathematics, and certainly don't have it in computer science. Of course, we have some dictionaries, but I mean, we don't have the kind of thorough scholarly dictionaries that we've got to have. And we will have in due time, but if anybody has a taste for dictionary making, feel free.
Next question. My name is Cuthbert Hurd. I'm from California. I have a partial but fairly grandiose suggestion to make in answer to Nat Rochester's question about how do we preserve these things. I live on a hill across from another hill at which the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory of Stanford is located. And by using a bogus charge number, I can go over there and use a text editing system which they have. And I find it tremendously useful, because this system, for example, helps you not only with line justification and hyphenation and paragraphination, but pagination. And anytime you're working on history, you're always reminded of things. So you write a paragraph, and you think about something else, you want to replace it easily. And of course, if you can then record on micro... example, helps you not only with line justification and hyphenation and paragraphination, but pagination. And anytime you're working on history, you're always reminded of things. So you write a paragraph, and you think about something else, you want to replace it easily. And of course, if you can then record on microfilm, as this particular system at the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory can, that's great. So here's Dr. John Pasta, who was kind enough to help get money from the National Science Foundation for this conference. Maybe he ought to think about making available to each of us some kind of a text editing system to help us in writing our history.
Brian Randall, University of Newcastle upon Tyne. Let me, with a strong British accent, take up Nat Rochester's point and tell the British scientists of the work of Professor Going at the University of Oxford, who runs for the Royal Society, a centre whose title is something like Centre for the Documentation of Contemporary Science. She provides a service for archiving material, manuscript material, and then seeing that it is deposited in an appropriate library. She already has charge of the late Chris Strachey's papers, is trying to do something with Turing's papers, etc. I know that she'll be very glad indeed to be approached by people. Now let me turn just to one thing said by Professor May and put on record my gratitude to Professor May for the brief but very useful manual in his massive tome on the bibliography of history of mathematics. The brief manual there, 30 or 40 pages, I found of tremendous use to me in my own rather amateur work on the history of computing. I only wish I'd found it earlier. And I would urge all of you to... There may be a large number of such manuals, but I will certainly give a very strong plug for that one.
Well, let me thank the speaker very much for that and say something about that. There are some sample copies of just the manual that's been just reprinted by me out of that book. There is a little problem with getting that manual. The book has sold out its first edition and is now out of print, the book itself. But if any of you would like the manual separately, if you write to me, I'll send you a copy. If you find it in your hearts to send me 50 cents or a dollar, that would be helpful. But you get it anyway.
By price.
Thank you very much for these corrections. You know, I was guilty, that's very nice, that I was guilty of the sort of ahistorical assertion that I was warning you against, because I knew very well that this was a special purpose analog computer. And I guess what I was thinking rather carelessly is that, after all, in doing this analog computing, it was doing arithmetical operations. But it was not a general purpose calculator for them. It was a specialized device. That's quite right. And thank you very much for your other corrections, too.
Neville Black at Los Alamos. You've mentioned, the audience has mentioned, mechanisms for the preservation of what amount to personal manuscript papers of, connected with individuals. One of the most important and evanescent materials in computing are the vastly anonymous manuals. How does one find a first folio Fortran? Where does one get a Datatron manual? Commercial organizations, unfortunately, regard the taking up of a little space for a few years as rather a high crime. Perhaps the archives of IBM are adequate to their own, but there have been many other streams of technical documentation. It would seem relatively easy to arrange for some systematic mechanism by which copies of manuals could be acquired.
It would certainly be a great thing if the AMC or some organization, or if not some institution, were to take it upon themselves to collect these things, because otherwise the fate of them will be the same as these putative manuals that must have existed in ancient times. You know, they just get lost and could disappear altogether.
Next question in the rear.
I'm John Brillhart from the University of Arizona. I have two comments. First is, I've brought a chart from the Museum of Science in London on the history of computers that I've put out on the blackboard here. I've already heard comments about where is this or where is that or something by people. So I think it might be useful if I put up next to it a comments chart, and I encourage you to make any comments or corrections with regard to that chart, and I'll send it to the Science Museum. They may be able to make corrections that way. The second thing, I'd like to raise a question. I've been interested in factoring integers and their primality testing as well, and Professor May has commented on the arithmetic activities of the Greeks in particular. I was wondering if this really is a modern question, like taking a given integer and asking whether it's prime or how it should factor. Seems to me the Greeks never seem to have looked into that. They did know about primes, and they investigated it, but is there any evidence that they would take a number and try to factor it, or to show that it's prime?
I think there's quite a bit of evidence about work on primes by the Greeks, but I was going to refer you to our colleague two seats over from yourself, who would probably be able to answer that better. I think this is a very old thing, though. Isn't that right?
This is Lamer from the University of California in Berkeley. I would immediately shift the question over to Ellie Dixon's History of the Theory of Numbers, Volume 1.
Right.
And there's quite a lot of Greek material there, but it's pretty theoretical, and no real examples of anything extraordinary in the computing field.
My name is Van Wijngaarden from the Mathematical Center in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, to be precise. May I make a little refinement still to the question of the mental calculating prodigies? The name of Wim Klein was mentioned, and Wim Klein actually is of the auditive type, and you can disturb him by talking Dutch to him when he is calculating. He worked years at my own institute, so I know him very well. But what's more interesting is that he had a brother who was killed during the war, who was also a calculating prodigy, but he was of the other type. And you could disturb him by lighting a match before his eyes, because it disturbed his screen. Thank you.
It's certainly a field for investigation, isn't it? Fascinating thing.